Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Today, we are airing a conversation that I had with author Hampton Sides on the release of the paperback version of his book, Hellhound on His Trail, The Electrifying Account of the Largest Manhunt in American History. It's the book he wrote about the assassination of Martin Luther King and the manhunt for his assassin, James Earl Ray. The conversation took place at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe in late March of this year. Let's talk a little bit about the book right now. The assassination of Martin Luther King is still so real for us as a nation, so horrific for those of us who still really love and carry on Martin Luther King's work and his vision. And this mystery that the book is on some level about is how a man who is essentially an intellectual and social worm can bring down a towering moral leader. And this is something that happens every day in wartime. And I've been thinking lately about how, on some level, the United States just keeps fighting and refighting the Civil War. What were James Earl Ray's political and personal motivations, as far as you could make out, in the research and writing of this book?
Well, motive is such a hard thing to understand. Trying to find some sort of clean, rational explanation for what is essentially an insane act of violence. And anyone who's looked at assassins has found this consistently to be true, that it's very unsatisfying when you get to the question of motive. You know, why did that guy shoot Reagan? He's trying to impress Jodie Foster. He had seen the movie Taxi Driver. You know, it makes sense to him in some way, in his own mixed-up mind, but it doesn't make sense to us. James Earl Ray is very much in that camp. It's not absolutely clear why he did it. And I am convinced that he did it. I'm also convinced that he had some help and that he had some money and he had some criminal underground dealings and that he hoped to get more money from all this. But after, you know, researching this for 3 years and reading every single shred of evidence that I could find, I decided that the evidence against him was overwhelming. And so you get to this question of motive. Why does someone do something like this? I think it made sense in his own mind. I think that he lied all the way to his grave, so we may never know the real answer, even from his perspective. But I think that you get close to the answer. And when you write a book like this, you inhabit someone's world for 3, 4, 5 years, and you try to think, you try to construct some sort of rationale. It certainly fit in with his racial politics. He was very keen on the Wallace for president campaign. He actually thought Wallace was going to win. And although it was the most successful independent political party, political campaign since Teddy Roosevelt's Bull Moose Party in 1968, Wallace for president, he was a very successful independent candidate. Of course, there was no chance he was actually going to win it. He actually told people that if he pulled off this crime, that Wallace was going to pardon him as president. So it fit into that racial politics that he had. But I think he also saw himself very much, James Earl Ray did, as a businessman. In the lore of his family, he was always the smart one. He was very, he was the businessman. He was the hustler. He knew about various bounties on Martin Luther King's life, and he talked about it in prison. This was going to be his retirement plan, killing Martin Luther King. When he got out of prison and he broke out of this maximum security prison in Missouri, it was one of about 5 different ideas he had floating around in his head. One of them was to become a porn director. He thought there was a lot of money in porn. I guess there is. There is now, anyway. He was also interested in locksmithing. He took a locksmithing course. He talked about immigrating to another country like Rhodesia. He had all these different schemes and self-help things, and he was really into hypnosis. He was really into a particular thing called psycho-cybernetics. I dare you to read this book. It's a, you know, a self-help book that talks about how we are like computers and we need to have, like computers do, you know, some sort of overarching purpose, some sort of goal that we're calculating towards. And it talks about actually, it makes many metaphors to guns and torpedoes and missiles and how you have to have a goal. You have to have something to aim at. And I believe ultimately that, to answer your question about motive, that the assassination of Martin Luther King solved a lot of psychological problems that this guy had. It gave him something to plan for. It gave him a goal. It gave him some purpose. It fit in with his racial politics. And it also fit in with his idea of being this businessman. The irony is that he spent his whole criminal career striving for anonymity. Everything he did was to not be noticed, both in prison and outside of prison. He was always changing his name. He got a nose job shortly before the assassination because there was something about his nose he didn't like. He wore drab clothes, nice clothes, but always tried to fit in and always said that he wanted to have a face that no one would remember. And he pretty much succeeded in this striving for anonymity, and yet he pulls off this act that is calculated to make him infamous for the rest of his life. So I think that ultimately, and this is certainly true with a lot of assassins, there is an element of wanting recognition on some level and wanting to sort of express yourself and your grievances and your political and social, being a sort of a political and social misfit. And this is a way to lash out, and this is a way to express yourself. So those are some of the things. But ultimately, I think that James Earl Ray is he's a cipher in many ways. This is a guy who lied pathologically. He had 37 different identities in the course of his life. He had 8 or 9 during the course of the story I tell. He was John Willard. He was Eric Galt. He was Ramon Snade. He was Paul Bridgman. On and on it goes. So in the end, what you end up with is an incoherent identity. And to me, that's much more terrifying than someone like John Wilkes Booth, who did it for reasons he stated, who had a career, who had a set of politics that he and admitted, you know, acknowledged what he did and didn't deny it. Ray, on the other hand, lied the rest of his incarceration. So he's a very tough cookie. He's a very difficult guy to figure out.
There's an irony that you point out, which is that J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, which had been trying to bring King down for years and did a great job doing the manhunt, very, very good job, and you describe it in great detail in the book, and it's one of the things that's made people call your book a thriller, which is, I know, a term that you're not that thrilled with. But how do you understand that irony? I mean, was it, okay, we can bring him down, but nobody else gets to? I mean, what's going on?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's no question about the fact that J. Edgar Hoover hated Martin Luther King. There's no question about the fact that his FBI did everything it could do for a long time to ruin King and to ruin the movement, eavesdropping on him, bugging his telephones, urging him, in one extreme example, to commit suicide in this anonymous note that was sent to him and that was opened by Coretta Scott King, in which they had pasted together sort of the greatest hits of King's various indiscretions. I mean, it was tapes, various tapes of men in ecstasy. You couldn't tell really who was doing what exactly, but you know, it was meant to scare him and make him think that he needed to go ahead and kill himself rather than have this exposed. The lengths that the FBI went to in its COINTELPRO program in the late 1960s was extraordinary. So when this assassination happens, and Ramsey Clark, who is the Attorney General of the United States, decides that it's the FBI that's going to do this. This is much too big for the Memphis Police Department or the Tennessee authorities to deal with, and that it's also an international case, and that this is a civil rights figure of international import. It was obvious that the FBI had to take it on, but J. Edgar Hoover didn't want to at first, and he absolutely refused until the phone call came from Ramsey Clark. So what you end up with is this manhunt that is run on a very dysfunctional level. You have essentially, okay, you have the President of the United States, LBJ, who was a great admirer of King earlier in his presidency, but who is at odds with King now because of King's very vocal and very eloquent criticism of the Vietnam War. And then you have an attorney general, a young, idealistic, liberal attorney general, Ramsey Clark, who absolutely admires King and had followed him very closely and had been at Selma and who had worried for years about that something like this was going to happen, an assassination of Martin Luther King. And then you have the guy who is, the head of the FBI, who doesn't really have a boss. If he has a boss, it's this idealistic Ramsey Clark, but in fact, of course, everyone knows J. Edgar Hoover doesn't really have a boss, who hates King and thinks King was a subversive and a communist and bringing down the country and was up to all kinds of nefarious doings. And yet these are the people running this manhunt. The nation is burning. There are fires and riots in 150 cities. The Congress is clamoring for the FBI to find this guy or guys if it's some sort of conspiracy. There's an enormous amount of political pressure bearing down on the FBI. And what I found was that once the FBI got engaged in what it's actually supposed to do, which is solving crimes of national importance, they were really, really good at it. Once it got down to the level of the field agents, the guys who are doing the shoe leather, you know, doing the real work. And this manhunt, which was undertaken before the advent of computers, it's kind of an old-fashioned manhunt, one of the last old-fashioned manhunts, gets down to the level of, you know, smudged registration cards and certificates and fingerprints and fibers, these tiny little numbers stamped on the inseam of some undershorts, a microscopic set of numbers on the housing of a transistor radio, all of these kinds of details, one leading to the next, formed the second half of my narrative, which was how did they catch this guy? No matter what you think about him and whether he did it alone or did it in a group, this was, at the time, the largest manhunt in American history. It involved 3,000 FBI agents. It cost many millions of dollars. It also required the services of the law enforcement agencies of Mexico, Canada, Portugal, and ultimately England, where he was caught 65 days later by Scotland Yard at Heathrow Airport as he was about to board a plane en route to Rhodesia. So it's a fascinating detective story, and yeah, a lot of the critics or the reviewers have called it a thriller, meaning it, I think, as a compliment. But I find it hard to think of this story as a thriller. I mean, it's also a requiem about the end of a movement, the last days of a great man, and about a city that I know and love, Memphis, where I grew up, and an event that just shook my hometown to its very core. So it's got a lot of other dimensions, but this story of the manhunt sort of captures the energies of the last half of the book.
What was it like for you writing about the city where King was killed, Memphis, when you grew up there? It's a city that you know so well and love.
Oh, Memphis is a great city. I mean, it's a dysfunctional city in many ways. It's the capital of the Mississippi Delta, which is often described as the most southern place on Earth. It's the place in the Delta is the sort of the last iteration of the southern planter lifestyle, where just before the Civil War, the woods were cleared from the Delta, and this amazingly rich soil was subjected to, you know, the last expression of kind of the whole cotton lifestyle. And so it was sort of southern with a vengeance. And it was obvious to people that this was a lifestyle that was not going to work ultimately. But the plantation mentality, I think, moved to the city. Memphis was a city that was very much run like a plantation. It was a city that had been run by a political boss named E.H. Crump for many, many years prior to the events that I describe in my story. And it's a city that didn't think at the time that it had a racial problem. It had successfully integrated most of its schools without great incident. It was a city that kind of had a business ethic, thought that it was a little more progressive than some of the other southern cities. And in many ways, it was progressive. And certainly the music scene in Memphis with Stax Records and Sun Records and the Blues on Beale Street, the music scene had done more to integrate the nation than a lot of you know, a lot of pieces of legislation, I think, in terms of breaking down barriers. It was a very open, racially open city in terms of its music scene. It was also a very closed city racially in other ways. So this was an event that really tested the city to its very foundations. And the event, of course, those of you who don't know the story, the reason King came to Memphis was to represent garbage workers who were on strike. And the strike was provoked by an incident where two garbage workers were ground up in a faulty mechanism of one of these trucks. And the city didn't pay for their funeral and didn't want to pay for, or they maybe they paid for their funeral and they didn't pay for anything else in terms of benefits to the widows. And that was the provoking incident, but in fact, there was all sorts of grievances that they had had for years about their pay, about the fact that there was no union, about the fact that there was no showers for these guys that worked with the garbage every day with these tubs that they hoisted on their shoulders that they couldn't shower off at the end of the day. So they wanted very basic things, and the city was very intransigent and dealing with their requests, which became demands, and then King came to march on their behalf. So I don't know. Going back to Memphis, though, to do this story, I imagine that it would be really easy because I felt like I knew this city, and I found it to be much harder than any of my other books to research because, number one, I had to disabuse myself of all my assumptions. I thought I knew this city. I thought I knew this period. I was 60 years old at the time of these events, but in fact, I found I didn't know Memphis at all. And things that had been handed down from my family were wrong in many cases or were biased in some way. I also found myself getting sucked into all the psychodramas of Memphis, you know, friends and family, and it's a pretty funky place, and you know, you can lose a lot of ground and stay out very late every night hearing amazing stories, gothic stories, fascinating people in this odd town that have nothing to do with Martin Luther King's assassination. So I kept getting on these detours, and it ended up, I think, being harder for me to research this book than it would have been if it had been in a city that I'd never set foot in. But that said, I think Memphis is very much a major character of this book. The story keeps circling back to Memphis in many ways, literally and figuratively. And it really struck me as almost scripted by fate that this assassination happened in Memphis, the capital of blues, the capital of the Delta, this city named after an Egyptian capital with all of the Egyptian sort of overlay and metaphors that King alluded to in the speech that he gave the night before he was killed. You know, Memphis on the Nile, Memphis on the Mississippi, it's pretty deep stuff. And I think in some way, if King had premonitions that it was going to happen in Memphis, it certainly seemed like it certainly seemed scripted by, you know, almost like a Greek tragedy or something, that it would have happened of all the places that King was constantly traveling in, that it would have happened in Memphis. So it's unusual.
Tell us about the title of the book, Hellhound on His Trail.
Well, anyone who knows much about Delta blues knows that one of the great Delta bluesmen was Robert Johnson, who wrote this song, Hellhound on My Trail, which is a song about being pursued by fate or by the law or by history or by... you can read it on many levels. Johnson, of course, was the guy who said that he... the legend was that he met the devil at midnight at the crossroads and learned to, you know, sold his soul to the devil so he could learn to play guitar so that he was... because he had this uncanny improvement in his musical abilities. He was apparently had no musical talents whatsoever, it seemed like, in his teens, and then suddenly he showed up somewhere in a juke joint and was just, you know, just playing the strings off this guitar, and no one could figure out where he learned all this stuff. So the idea of selling your soul to the devil to learn to play guitar and always looking over your shoulder, thinking your end could come at any point because the devil is coming... that's the part of the bargain, of course. The Faustian bargain is the devil's going to take you. I thought it was a good title because King came to Memphis to represent these garbage workers who were themselves, almost all of them, from the Mississippi Delta and who were from Johnson country and who were and Johnson himself had lived in and around Memphis his whole life, his short, tragic life. And King was pursued by the FBI and by history and by fate. And then the story, of course, shifts after the assassination. It's a story of the FBI chasing and hounding James Earl Ray all the way to London. So it works on multiple levels. And I also found this quote that that Martin Luther King talked about, where he says that discrimination is a hellhound that pursues Negroes each and every day. That's a sort of a paraphrase. But this was just a term. Hellhound, though, is also a very hard word to say. And people all over the country have said, I mean, I've had hellbent, I've had hellbound, I've had, let's see, somebody said hellbound for some tail. They thought it was, I mean, I've gotten everything. So it is a little bit of a tongue twister for those who are not familiar with the blues.
Or a Freudian slip.
Yeah, perhaps.
So in your research for the book, you searched very hard for evidence because, of course, a lot of people thought this was a conspiracy. And so you looked into every piece of evidence that might lead to the idea that there really was a conspiracy. You basically found no hard evidence to suggest a conspiracy. And yet, when you go out on tour, a lot of your readers and audiences just don't like your conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Conspiracy is a big part of this story. And I got to say that I grossly underestimated the ferocity of the conspiracy camp. These guys, and they almost all are guys, many of them wear toupees and they're insomniacs and they're are very... you know, I'm used to having people like my books or not like my books. I'm not used to having my book be a personal affront to someone's entire worldview. And that's what I kept encountering, these people who were just very angry with me because they believe in all conspiracies, most of them. They really believe it's JFK, RFK, 9/11, and of course MLK, and a lot of other ones. And they go to the conventions and they try to write these things that sort of connect the dots to all of these different stories. And so what I have to say to them and what I say to anyone on this question is that, yeah, I did take very seriously the idea that there could be a conspiracy. It's not unreasonable to think of a conspiracy, given the role of J. Edgar Hoover, given how important Martin Luther King was, given how controversial he was. I think we're hardwired as human beings to look for conspiracy whenever there's a crime, and especially a complicated crime like this. And I don't have, you know, I believe that conspiracies and cover-ups happen all the time, have happened throughout our history. I don't have any sort of patriotic or, you know, emotional investment in believing that my government is always good or something like that. It's just that in this one case, after reviewing many, many, many hundreds of thousands of pages of documents and thinking about every angle, I came to the conclusion that James Earl Ray was guilty. And though I think he had some help, and though I think that there was at least a small, crude conspiracy, I don't see any evidence for this larger, shadowy conspiracy in which James Earl Ray was just a patsy or a fall guy or whatever. So that's the conclusion I come to. If it disappoints members of the conspiracy camp, I guess that's just, you know, something you deal with. I have gotten things like... Hampton Sides is clearly a pseudonym created by the CIA. Someone said that in a gathering in Philadelphia. I've gotten the fact that I am a paid publicist of the FBI, or I was in the FBI. Believe me, I am not a good candidate for the FBI. I mean, I inhaled. And I wouldn't pass the test. I find it amusing at first, but then I start to get a little agitated and a little annoyed at the fact that the ferocity, as I say, of this assumption. It's the way these conspiracy folks think that you can't have independently arrived at a conclusion like this. You have to be part of the conspiracy. And then the newspapers who have favorably reviewed my book are part of the conspiracy, and the television shows that have, you know, and you're part of the conspiracy now. I'm sorry. So it's kind of a weird thing, the way conspiracies work. And someone asked me, are you going to write about the the Kennedy assassination next? And I, you know, absolutely not. I'm done with the conspiracy thing. I didn't see it coming. I knew they were out there, but I didn't really realize how intense they are. Yeah.
So I guess you won't take on 9/11.
Oh, God, not now. Not now. Maybe one day.
So it's interesting because the conspiracy theory people, on some level, as you say, are trying to make sense of a horrible thing. Mm-hmm. Another way that people try to make sense of senseless violence like this against somebody who is such an incredible leader is to say things like, well, his ideas lived on and he was greater in his martyrdom and after his death, and his ideas lived because of that. And what's your response to that?
Hmm. Well, I think King would be 82, 83 if he were among us today, and he would, you know, just imagine what kind of force he would be, a guiding influence he'd be if he had lived. He would have had ups and downs in his political popularity or whatever, but just imagine what kind of guiding influence he would have on our society. So I think I don't subscribe to the idea that he achieved more in martyrdom than he would have if he'd lived. He certainly became, you know, he certainly had a certain power. There was certain power that came from martyrdom. We have a national holiday in his name, and in his name, of course, we're talking about the whole movement that he stood for and all these thousands and millions of people who marched with him. I don't know, though. In the end, I think, I stick to that earlier idea that he would have done more. He could be a diplomat. He could be a moderator. He could be, a university president. He could be an international figure of great importance, and would still be today if he had lived.
You write in the book about the culture of violence and hatred, which is so very much part of our society, and I keep seeing the influence of the Civil War, and it's not a neat North-South divide by any means, mm-hmm. and we have people who perhaps everybody in this room is not part of that culture of violence, and in fact, probably everybody is in some level working in their own way against that, and yet there it is in this black-white thing, in this immigrant-non-immigrant set of debates, and the vitriol that comes out to this day, both in the media, in political discourse, in private discourse, is daunting, and I just wondered how you felt that, how you see that our contemporary political situation has and has not evolved since 1968.
Well, I guess it's Mark Twain who said that history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes. And there's definitely a lot of rhyming going on right now, it seems to me, between the late 60s and today. I mean, we're fighting this sort of controversial, unpopular war on the other side of the planet against an enemy that's hard to find, a war that doesn't seem to have a clear ending, and it's sort of draining the nation's coffers. We have this guy in the White House who is kind of a curious amalgam of JFK, RFK, and MLK. We have this in the Tea Party movement and other similar movements along the spectrum. We have a movement that is like the Wallace movement before it, is succeeding in sort of channeling and capturing and amplifying certain reactionary forces in our society. There's a lot of superficial, at least, if not also deeper, similarities between the late 60s and today. And then this culture of hate thing, which, you know, it's definitely out there. They didn't have the internet back in 1968, but they had things like the Wallace Movement and the White Citizens Councils and a lot of Southern businessmen's associations, and there were lots of respectable ways to be a racist back in the late 60s. And today, you know, you can do it sort of in the privacy of your own laptop. I think that the culture of hate certainly was complicit in this crime, in the sense that George Wallace I don't think he was going around telling people, go kill Martin Luther King. But he created an inflamed environment where people like James Earl Ray, who are lost souls but also pretty ambitious, could begin to think that it would be possible, that it might even be noble to do something like this, that history would smile on him, that he'd be pardoned, that he'd help the presidential campaign. I think demagogues like Wallace didn't always understand the far-reaching consequences of what they were saying. Maybe they did. He wasn't saying kill King. And I don't blame Wallace directly for this crime in any way. But the culture of hate was there in 68, and it's still very much here today. And, there's some similarities with what happened in Arizona. That assassin there was truly psychotic, and he had a lot of there's so many differences in the crimes as well. But, he had a kind of incoherent political ideas. And it was clear to him, I think it's clear to all of us, that he was lashing out at a political figure who was charismatic and young, and he thought he'd get some attention with it. And I guess he did. I guess that's in a sad way, he succeeded in that way.
So how did you choose this story, and indeed, how do you choose the various stories when you decide what your next book is going to be about?
Mm. That's a good question. I think I kind of have like historical ADD, because I jump around a lot. My first history was about the Bataan Death March in World War II and the rescue of some of the last survivors of the Death March in the Philippines. And I was drawn to that story for personal reasons, just because I met some amazing veterans who had gone through that experience. And more people from New Mexico than from any other state were killed in the Death March. And so I guess in a way I am consistently drawn to stories that are sort of in my backyard. It's like, I think that we have a tendency to think that great stories are found in New York and London and, Paris. But, usually they're found in your backyard. They're just some guy you meet, and he tells you this story, and you're like, God, I never heard that before. Or that person makes it personal, and you think about that story in a way you never thought about before. My second book, the one that I probably spent the most time on, was a book called Blood and Thunder, about the life and times of Kit Carson and his controversial role in the conquest of the American West. I spent 5 years on that traveled all over the West. And again, I think it was a desire to understand my own backyard. I just kept running into the name Kit Carson everywhere I went. Kit Carson National Forests, Kit Carson Peak, Kit Carson Park in Taos. There are lakes, there are streams, there's Carson City, Nevada. I just wondered, okay, who is this guy? I'm supposed to know who he was, and I really couldn't tell you whether he was a genocidal maniac or a national folk hero. And that kept me busy for a while. And then this book, again, was a desire to go back, I think, to my own backyard, and in this case to everyone wants, I think all writers need to go back to the place where they were born at some point, and this was a chance for me to go back to Memphis, at the pivotal moment in Memphis's history, I think, one of the very pivotal moments, and try to understand it and sort of deconstruct it. My next book is about an event that happened in 1879. It's a polar exploration story that is not very well known. It's American-led exploration. They thought they were going to make it to the North Pole. Like most of these stories, it's disastrous, and they end up in Siberia and good times, scurvy, cannibalism. Luckily, many people survive, and not all of them survive, but many of them survive so that we have, accounts of what happened. But it's a story about Gilded Age exploration and kind of the early days of the American Empire trying to sort of become a world power and compete with the British and some of the other European powers in terms of just pure exploration. What does it all add up to?
Do you have a title for that?
I don't have a title, no. What does it all add up to? I'm not really sure. I mean, these stories, I'm drawn to stories that involve strife, that involve some sort of human stressful situation that challenges people and that brings out something in their personalities. A friend of mine said, I'm interested in human disasters. Not natural disasters, but human disasters. You know, they're tragedies. I guess all these are kind of tragic situations. They may have happy endings. They may not have happy endings. But they're all sort of human-caused social storms. And I'm interested in how people sort of survive them, endure them, and through some combination of smarts and grace and physical, emotional endurance, how they get through these stories and through these tragedies.
There are so many parts to writing a book like this. You come up with the idea, you begin to research it, you write in a coffee shop, you rewrite, you go through the editing process, the book is published, you go on radio and TV, you travel all over the place, then the paperback comes out, you do it again. What are your favorite and least favorite parts of that process?
The phase that I'm in right now with my new book is the fun phase. It's when you're collecting all the documents, you're finding out where the archives are, you're getting to know people in who the curators are. You're traveling, you're building something, and it's an exciting feeling when you could see this thing taking shape. It's the structure is really building and gestating in your mind. Then you get a phase that I call the pain cave, which is just, it's not fun. You're really just struggling to get that first draft together, and your hygiene is not very good. And it's like, you know, what is the structure? What is the storyline? This is horrible. And you're muttering to yourself a lot. And then you come out, I come out of the pain cave into feeling like I really do have a story, and then it gets fun again when you start to polish what you have, and it's creative, and you can see the light at the end of the tunnel. The book tour part, I enjoy it. I don't love it exactly. I don't. There are some people who are really much better book tour people than they are writers, But I think it's really important. For communication to come full circle, to go out and meet the people who are buying your books, to hear things from them, to learn things. Sometimes you learn things that you wish you had known all along, like where were they during the research phase? Like this book, for example, some interesting things that happened. I was in St. Louis, and three people came up to me after the talk. One of them said I was in prison with James Earl Ray for 20 years. And I got some stories to tell you, you know. Like, I got his name and number, and it was very interesting. And if I had known some of the things that he told me, they would have made their way into the book. The next guy that came up right behind him said, I was a lawyer who represented James Earl Ray in one of his earlier crimes. And, man, I've got some stories to tell you. Then the third person who came up to me I told me that she was Martin Luther King's daughter. From another marriage, another marriage. Of course, now everyone who'd ever known a celebrity has heard these stories about, like, oh yeah, I'm Frank Sinatra's, son or something, illegitimate, whatever. But she was very serious about it, and she somehow wanted me to know this, and yet she didn't want to talk about it at the same time. It was. In fact, this happened in two different cities. Richmond, Virginia, and in St. Louis. So I don't know what to make of that. It's just, there it is. Maybe it's not true. Maybe it is true. Maybe they're deluded. But it's just, book tours are funny that way. The kinds of people who come up to you and say things. And if you had only known these things when you were writing the book.
How do you make the call out to people? I mean, some of them you're never going to find until the book tour, but before, when you're researching, I mean, is the internet a vehicle whereby you can say, hey, did any of you ever do time with...
to broadcast things like... it's possible through the internet to get increasingly, focused communications with people. The internet doesn't just help journalists. It really helps historians, too. And so much of my research was done on the web. But yeah, it's kind of hard to find some of these people. Some people, like the ones I just described, can only be found by going on book tours. Then maybe writing a second edition later and incorporate what you've learned.
Or a third. Mm-hmm. Blood and Thunder is a great story. We talked about that on KSFR and the Radio Cafe when it came out. Now, there is talk of a miniseries. Is that right?
That's right. Blood and Thunder. Okay, so when it first was when it first came out, it was optioned by Spielberg, and he hired a really good screenwriter based right here in Santa Fe named Kirk Ellis to write the screenplay, and he did a great job. But I think it just suffered from being a feature film is only 2 hours, and Kit Carson's life story, and this is not by any means a biopic, but everything about it is big. The landscape is big. The chronology is big. His movements across the country. It's a huge story. It's just absolutely too big for a feature film. So a great local producer here named Tony Mark, who was, some of you may know him, he was the executive producer of The Hurt Locker, which won the Best Picture last year. And he said, this is a miniseries. Let's make it a miniseries, and let's try to make it in New Mexico. Would that be okay with you? And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. So we've gotten involved with Redford's group, Wildwood. Redford lives here in Santa Fe now. It's his principal residence. And, this is a story kind of tailor-made for Robert Redford because it's about, Hispanic America. It's about Native America. It's about the West and landscapes and the mountain men. It's a natural for Wildwood. So they're involved now, and we're just trying to find a home for it, and either with HBO, Stars, History Channel, wherever it's going to be. So more on that later, but hopefully. And our goal here really is to have this thing filmed in New Mexico and not Romania.
We're listening to a conversation between me and Hampton Sides, author of the book Hellhound on His Trail, The Electrifying Account of the Largest Manhunt in American History. So I wanted to open it up to the audience and see if anybody has any questions.
I have two questions. They're kind of related. Do you have an opinion about why there was nobody who really took up the mantle of leadership in the black community after Martin Luther King died? And related to that one, do you have an opinion about the impact this had on Jesse Jackson and what his experience and what came of his life following the assassination?
Well, I think Jackson tried to take up the mantle. And, I talk a little bit about how Jackson tried to take up the mantle, within hours, within minutes of the assassination. And I don't want to give that away other than to say that he didn't, he's had a very interesting career and he's done amazing things, but he didn't acquit himself very well that day, April 4th, with the bloody shirt and all the claims of him dying in his arms and all that. I think people have tried to take up the mantle, but, it's a testament to how amazing King was, I think, that no one was successful. King, some combination of his smarts, his eloquence, his ability to speak so many different dialects of American language, the way he can move effortlessly into all these different situations, his savvy as a political strategist. There's just no one that really came close after that. Some of the lieutenants that he had, I was most impressed by Andrew Young. I think he maybe came closest and certainly had quite a career afterwards. But it's also possible that, the movement had come to not an end by any means, but a kind of a stasis. It was fraying in many different directions. There were lots of different ideas about where the movement was supposed to go, whether it goes into economic issues, social issues. But the main obvious victories in terms of public accommodations, voting, and so forth, basic civil rights, had been won. And so even King in his last years was a little bit unsure which way the movement should go. You see that in those last 2 years or so where he's experimenting with different things and he's got some fairly radical notions about redistributing wealth in America that are not very popular, and he's very controversial. So I think that whoever would have taken up the mantle would have had a hard time enjoying the kind of clarity that the movement had in its early days.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for Blood and Thunder.
Thank you.
For me personally, it was one of those books that kind of became a life changer. So thank you. You mentioned all of the identities that James Earl Ray had. Was there any evidence that you found that he had more than one personality?
Well, you know, there are times when I thought that he had sort of the beginning of a multiple personality disorder. There were ways in which he inhabited these different names and changed his dress and changed his glasses and changed his hair and changed his nose. That made me think that, you know, that maybe he had that, the beginning of it. But I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't know enough about that disorder to be able to fully say whether he had that. But he also had trouble sometimes recognizing when the different personalities had exposed themselves to each other. For example, near the end of the story, when he's caught in London, he's insisting that he's not James Earl Ray, even though they have his fingerprints and they've got a lot of evidence against him. And so he's given this court-appointed barrister in London to handle the extradition proceedings, a very dignified English lawyer. And the lawyer says, you know, how can I help you? What can I do for you while we're waiting for the proceedings to take place? And he said, now he was known as, at this point, he called himself Ramon George Snade. Ramon George Snade. S-N-E-Y-D, Snade. And he called himself Sir Snade. And he insisted that he was not James Earl Ray. So the barrister says, how can I help you? What can I do? And he said, well, I would like for you to contact my brother back in the United States. Sure, no problem. How can I reach him? What's his name? Jerry Ray. And, you know, this lawyer was just like, is this guy stupid? I mean, he didn't betray any feeling of like he'd really exposed himself in any way. But he absolutely insisted that he was not James Earl Ray, even when he came on a special plane, Air Force plane from London and landed in Memphis in the summer of 68. He still was calling himself Snade. So I don't know. You know, the story that he gave after he confessed and plea bargained and all this, he recanted his confession 3 days later and said that he had done all these things that he'd been accused of, except for the pulling the trigger part. That was done by a guy named Raoul, the mysterious Raoul. And I'm convinced that this guy Raoul was, you know, just another one of these identities that he cooked up. It may have been a composite of various people he had known, or maybe he was trying to protect someone like his brothers. Yet another identity is what I'm trying to say here. You know, it's like this is a guy who spent his whole criminal career creating identities, and he was doing it even after he'd, you know, been caught. And but he stuck with that Raoul story for really till the day he died. He changed it a lot. This Raoul went from being a guy from Montreal to being this Portuguese guy, and, you know, he was Spanish for a while, Latin American. But he stuck with the Raoul story, and I think it's a testament to our hunger for conspiracies that the Raoul story has stuck, because there's not a shred of evidence that this guy ever existed. You know, it's just it's a mysterious sounding name, Raoul. You know, that's about all you have.
In your talking about carrying King's mantle, I'm curious that you didn't mention Congressman John Lewis, who,
yes,
from everything that I have read, I mean, he was even more radical, but he was very close, and he's constantly working on carrying out the beloved community, the whole teaching of nonviolence. And
yeah,
I was just wondering, because I hold him in such high,
yeah,
esteem, if you talked to him at all in the course of your research, or who else do you talk to in your research?
I didn't talk to John Lewis, only because he really wasn't involved in these last few days, last few weeks of King's life. I didn't go into Selma. I didn't go into some of the great things that he did with King. You know, there's been amazing books about, you know, biographies of King that really, I highly recommend Taylor Branch's trilogy of King, in which John Lewis plays an important role. I would love to talk to him, though. I mean, you know, I don't think, you know, I just don't think he didn't know anything particular about what was happening in Memphis. He wasn't in Memphis. I do agree that he's one of the stalwarts. He's one of the great ones. He's done great things, and sometimes I don't think of him as being so. How to put this? I mean, it's like he sort of quietly, patiently, stubbornly built this career, which is so admirable. Where you know he wasn't a preacher. He wasn't trying to draw attention to himself. He was trying to do things with his career and change laws, and I think he has done that very much so. But I mean, God, the bravery that he showed in Selma, I mean, that's he's an American hero. I mean, there's no question about it. I guess I thought of when I said Andrew Young, I was thinking about his sort of immediate Southern Christian Leadership Conference entourage, and of all those, I think Young was the one who went on to great things the most. Abernathy, of course, took over right after King was assassinated and did some extraordinary things as well. But again, the movement was changing. The next thing that they did after King died, the Poor People's Campaign in Washington was not very successful. It was an interesting experiment, and it had some high moments, but it was a failure, I think, in many ways. And that figures into my story, actually. And I guess John Lewis was involved in Poor People's Campaign a little bit. But anyway, I'm glad you brought him up. He's a great man.
I'm thinking of him, Martin Luther King Jr., as the man and as his ability to have a worldview and inspire people mm-hmm. in the same way that Kennedy could inspire people. Mm-hmm. And yet they both seemed to think that their private lives wouldn't have any bearing on what they are doing. And there seems to be a blind spot with some of these great, great people that have this wonderful ability, and yet they don't realize what they're doing to their family or even mm-hmm. to the movement. Mm-hmm. And then the second part is he was such an easy target on the balcony at the Lorraine Motel. It seems to me that he did have a death wish or he knew that he would soon die. Mm.
Okay, well, the first thing, I don't dwell on it by any means, but I don't ignore it. He did have a weakness for women. He had dalliances. He had mistresses. This is well known. It's not talked about very much because it's a very delicate thing to talk about, a Nobel laureate and a person who has a national holiday named after him, to realize that he also had this issue. I mean, it may not have been as bad as Hoover thought it was, for example, but he did have this problem. And I spoke with one of his mistresses at some great... It's at great length in Louisville, Georgia Davis, who's a very nice person and a very absolutely credible person. He had other mistresses in other cities. His marriage with Coretta was troubled by that point. There's no question about it. A combination of all of his travels and all the stresses on his life and these dalliances. I don't know why. I don't really speculate on like why it is that these leaders who are so charismatic and so powerful, and in his case, powerful only by virtue of his message. He wasn't a senator. He wasn't a CEO of anything. He wasn't particularly wealthy. He's just the moral force of his personality and the charisma and his eloquence is what made him, I think, so desirable to so many women. And who knows why? And he certainly was aware, in his last speeches and last sermons in the last years of his life, he spoke a lot about, there are two selves and we have to hold the better self up and try to, he seemed to grapple with his, his own weaknesses and was profoundly aware of them. And he wasn't anything as crazy. I mean, I read the book on... was it called The Dark Side of Camelot? Seymour Hersh's book about JFK. I mean, it wasn't anything crazy like erotic asphyxiation or hookers and crazy stuff that JFK did. It was he had long-term relationships with mistresses in many cities, that he women he loved and respected and who were intellectually his equal. And he wasn't a sexual adventurer in quite the way that, say, JFK and RFK were. The second part of your question was about what an easy target he was. I think people who think about King now we know that he is a national, international figure who is a national holiday. We assume that he must have had bodyguards and that he must have had a secret service and that he must have had a big entourage of people with him who were shielding his movements we forget that he was a private citizen. When he was offered police details, he usually declined them, often because he said they would probably just spy on me, which they, of course, probably were. He didn't have any federal entourage. He didn't have any... the FBI was spying on him. They weren't protecting him. He personally did not believe in guns. He didn't believe that any of his groups should carry guns or any other kind of weapon. He thought it sent out all the wrong signals. This is a guy who built his life on nonviolence and staked his entire reputation on Gandhian principles, and he wasn't going to try to project this macho image with all these armed guys. The best he did is he had some football players, big dudes who walked around with him sometimes that were part of the SCLC. But he did not have a death wish. I don't agree with that. People have said that to me. I think there may have been times where he was very resigned to the fact that I'm going to die. I'm probably going to get killed. He got death threats all the time, including the night before he came to Memphis. The day he came to Memphis, excuse me, there was a bomb threat on the plane from Atlanta. He thought about it all the time. He didn't want it to completely alter the way he lived his life. He could have quit now. One of the things he could have done is just stopped and taken a sabbatical and become a university president or a diplomat or something. He could have done something very different. But and in that sense, he couldn't stop what he was doing. He was so closely tied to the movement that he didn't see any other way. And I think in that sense, he knew that the odds were pretty good that he was going to get killed. He talked about it all the time, including his last speech. I may not get there with you. And these are the sick white brothers that are out there. And it was very present in his mind. So, but I don't know specifically about the site at the Lorraine. How many of you have been to the National Civil Rights Museum, the Lorraine? A lot of you. It's a very exposed place. It's hard to imagine a more exposed place than that museum, than that, at the time, motel. Standing out on that balcony, the angles, the vantage points for a possible sniper were endless. And so he must have, it is kind of amazing that he lingered there for not 1 minute, not 2 minutes, but something like 6, 7, 8 minutes. And, that's what got him killed in this case. But it could have been anywhere else. I mean, everywhere he went, all these marches, he was exposed. He was out there. He put himself out there every day. And I think about that a lot, is just how brave he was and how, you could say it's a death wish, but I think it's more of a feeling that this is the only way that he can make his case, is by physically being there and being out there amongst the marchers and confronting policemen and tear gas and dogs and the whole thing. The physicality of it was important. And so on that moment, I think it was just I think he lost track of time. He was having a good time. He was actually having a very good day. He was very jovial. He had won a victory in court. He was joking with his staff. He was about to go have some soul food, a big dinner. He was all very excited and in a very good mood. And I think he lost track of time. And if someone had just said, get off of there 1 minute earlier, history might have been different. We have time for maybe one more.
Yeah, last question.
Last question. I think it was only after you had mentioned that you're writing a book or completing one on a polar expedition, and it's an American expedition, that began to see the word trail on Hellhound and then thinking of the Santa Fe Trail and the Oregon Trail in Blood and Thunder, and then the Death March. And I'm wondering if...
I do death marches, basically, yeah.
I wonder if you thought of yourself in a particularly American strain of American literature and history writing, where history is seen as being made on the road or being made on trails, and King was on the move all the time, and and Ray was, of course, as a guy on the lam, Kit Carson, the Death Marches. Do you see that as simply a coincidence, or do you feel that you're chronicling various American experiences seems to take you at least to that to that one theme of expedition and road and discovery and travel and being on the lam and hunting Indians and James Earl Ray's down?
Wow, that's really profound. I appreciate it's a good analysis. I think that it's...
I'm an English.
Oh, you can. Okay. Well, that explains it. Well, you know, the thing is, though, that I think it's not so much that I consciously gravitate to stories about being on the road, but I do think that I'm interested in narrative history. And, you know, conventional history, academic history has a very well-deserved reputation for being deadly dull. I mean, let's just face it. It's like chloroform in print. It can be very, very, very sleepy. It'll push you to sleep. And so you need action. You need movement. You need some sense of, you know, I think of some sort of the difference between a river and a stagnant pond or lake. You know, it's like there's something about a river that's always more interesting. There's twists and turns, and you know, there's a lot more oxygen in the water, you know. And I think that's what good narrative history aspires to do, is to have action and plot. Yes, there's time for reflection and analysis and backing up and explaining how we got on this march and why we're on this march, but I do gravitate towards stories, I guess, that have a lot of plot and have a lot of movement. Because I like to describe landscape. I think character. I think that landscape is probably consistently a character in my book, whether it's the Philippines or the American West or the American South. I'm interested in I've always been drawn to writing about land and weather and, you know, birds and, you know, physical things that you can describe that are part of the setting. I think setting is a big part of narrative history. You know, it's essentially setting and character that make narrative history work. The first writer, period, that I ever met was Shelby Foote in Memphis, the great Civil War historian, and he was really good at describing landscape, and he was certainly, I mean, that book, the trilogy, his Civil War trilogy, is just, it's full of action. It's just nonstop plot. Yeah, there's breathers for character analysis or a little, you know, set up before a big battle, but there's just a lot of action. And I guess that I'm drawn in all these cases to stories about that have a lot of plot. But it does, there was kind of a death march theme I had going there, because I had the death march in Bataan and then the long walk of the Navajo, which was very much a death march. King's story is a series of marches that are sometimes successful, sometimes not. And then this story is the ultimate slog. I mean, gosh, what these men went through in the North Pole, trying to get to the North Pole, well before, this is long before Scott and Amundsen and Shackleton and all of that. This is 1879. It is very much you know, it's a death march, I guess. Although, like I say, it's also a survival story. People survive, and it's extraordinary that any of them survive this tale. So in about 2 or 3 years, hopefully I'll be sitting here and we'll be talking, maybe with Mary Charlotte, about the new book. I do kind of have a working title for it on the proposal. It's called Extremes of the Earth, and it's really... you know, at the time, they thought they were operating under this really wacky science that was going to, they were going to sail, they were going to bust through a little bit of ice north of Siberia, and they were going to get into the North Pole area, which was supposed to be a warm shallow sea teeming with life and a lost civilization. And it's sort of indicative of how little was known about this place, that 33 men were willing to ram themselves in the ice and think that they were going to become, you know, glorified heroes. Stick with me. Make 2 or 3 years. We'll be back here. Dorothy will be hosting, and it'll be a great event. Thanks for coming tonight.
And once again, we've been listening to a conversation with Hampton Sides at the Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe that took place in March of this year. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.